Oh, good. Okay. It's working. All right. Good morning, all. So again, one last time, my name is David LaFour. I grew up going to church here in St. Luke's and grew up in Federal Way. And thinking about today's passage and the story, which is the story of the three wise men, I was reminded of a time when I was a kid. I think I was maybe somewhere between 8 and 10, and my grandparents, who lived out kind of by the Dash Point area, were going to move. They were kind of downsizing from a house that as an 8-year-old, thought was giant because, you know, it was two stories, to a house that was one story. And in this process, they had to go through a lot of their stuff and get rid of some things. I was brought along, and I was probably about as helpful as most 8 to 10-year-olds are. In a moving process, as in I just went immediately downstairs to the basement to go look at all the fun things that were being put in boxes, pick them up and not help anyone at all and ask, when are we going home? I'm bored. and I like to say that's just because I was a kid. I don't know how useful I am in moving situations now as an adult. Because these things really distract me. I just want to see all this stuff that's been down here forever. No one's ever touched it. So I remember one thing in particular. It was a series of books, and they had these yellowed pages, and they were kind of torn up a little bit. So I went over, I pulled one out, and it was by this guy. I don't know if you've heard of him, but his name was Tolkien, J.R.R. Tolkien, or something like that. And I don't know, the book smelled funny. That's honestly why I remember picking these up. It wasn't because I was interested in Tolkien. He looked like a boring old dude on the back. I didn't want to hear what he had to say. But, you know, I kind of flipped through them. They smelled funny. There were some cool maps and pictures and whatnot, so I was like, okay. Maybe I'll spend some time here. This could be my hangout spot for the next half hour. Well, my grandpa came down, and he saw me thumbing through those books, and he said, well, David, do you want them? And I was like, sure, I'm going to accept something free. That's great. Get it from grandpa. It's old. It's cool. It's whatever. I don't think I'm going to read it, but sure, I'll take them. So he gave me all of his Tolkien books, and taking them home, I remember thinking, well, these aren't going to be that exciting, but I decided to give one a try. Dad, my father, had suggested to read The Hobbit. He said it was probably the most fun one to read. So I picked it up, and the very first chapter grabs your attention. Tolkien starts a story by putting Bilbo Baggins, this little hobbit, in a comfortable hole in the Shire. And everything in his life is pretty much as he wants it to be. He has a nice home. He doesn't go on any crazy adventures or anything like that. Everything's very predictable. He has 6 meals a day plus tea time. It's great. But you all know that's not how the story could stay. No one's going to read that story. Immediately within the first chapter, there comes a knock on his door. He opens it up, and there is this absolutely strange character standing outside. It's a dwarf. They have long beards, they dress in funny clothes. It's not like the movies that you see now where they all look cool. No, they're wearing like bright yellow, bright purple, their beards are dyed. They're kind of odd people. And this dwarf just shows up, he's like, oh great, thanks, and walks in, makes himself at home. Throughout the rest of the evening, he goes ahead and welcomes 12 visitors, or 13 visitors, into his home. 12 dwarfs and one wizard. Now, the Shire was a small town, and everything that they saw, like, this was odd. What are these wizards, what are these dwarves doing here? Now, the reason why I remember this story is because it has to do with, well, I make it have to do in my head, with the story that we have today, with the Magi visiting Bethlehem. The story, as it's written in our Bible, usually it's titled The Visit of the Three Wise Men. Or in the song that we have, it's the three kings. But in the Bible, the Greek says that they're not kings or they're not wise men, but instead, they're magi. Now, what's a magi? Well, a magi is, well, it's kind of hard to explain. You don't have many examples of them. In the book of Daniel, magi are listed right alongside of sorcerers, wizards, and other pagan worshipers. So this image that we have of these wise men kind of traveling to Bethlehem because their philosophy or whatever, a little bit off of what the scripture has. Instead, the scripture paints these strange, completely unexpected characters showing up to go pay homage to Jesus. Now, I would think that the Magi in a small little town of Bethlehem are even more strange than 12 dwarves would be in the Shire. Or 12 dwarves, one hobbit, and a wizard. These are people from way, way, way far out east. They're probably dressed in funny clothes. They probably have long beards. They probably don't smell the same as everyone else there. They probably had their own brand of smell. And here they come to this small Jewish community where everyone knows everyone else, where you're a Jew, that's what you are, that's what you do. Who are these people showing up? And the story gets even more strange when we look at what the Magi say, because they don't say much. They don't really give an explanation. They don't tell people where they're from. They don't get into all that business. All they do is say, well, there was a star rising, so we went to go find it, because it meant that the king of the Jews was born. Now, the reading today, the first one from Numbers, it relates to the star that they saw. So there's a star rising. They're coming to pay homage to King of the Jews. It's already odd because they're magi, but it gets even more odd when you realize what this star rising means and what these prophecies say. What is this star? What is the star showing? Who is this King of the Jews? So, looking at this prophecy, it really harkens back to another Old Testament story involving another strange character. And you'll have to bear with me on the names here. There is a king. His name is Balak. And he is the king of the Amalekites, or Amalekites. And Balak is observing his kingdom, and he notices this nation is moving into the area. This nation is called Israel. Now, this is right after the story of Exodus. Israel had just escaped Egypt. They had the Red Sea, the 10 plagues. Everything is exciting and big, and they're coming in to this new promised land. And Balak, he doesn't like this. He doesn't want newcomers in his promised land. So he decides he's going to go ahead and get rid of them. So he sends a message to another guy with another odd name, whose name is Balaam. And Balaam is a Gentile. He's not a Jew, but he is a prophet. It's kind of an odd position in the Bible. He's not Jewish, but he is a prophet of the one true God. And Balak says to Balaam, the king says to the prophet, hey, I know that your words have power. Whoever you say is cursed, is cursed. And whoever you say is blessed, is blessed. So I want you to come on over here, get up on top of a mountain, and look out over the entire camp of Israel and curse them, because I don't want them coming into our country. And as all of us know, I'm sure, curses work best when you're on top of mountains. So Balak is very insistent on that. In fact, he brings them up to three different mountains, each with a different view of Israel, to really make sure he gets it right. And Balaam at first is like, this probably isn't a good idea. I know Israel is like, you know, God's country, so probably shouldn't speak out against them. But then Balak's like, come on, dude, I got a lot of money. I'm a big, powerful king. And Balaam's like, sure, why not? This will be great. So Balaam sets out to go find the mountain. And as often happens in the Bible, well, God had different plans for him, essentially. Meets him on the road, and with the threat of an angel with a sword in his hand, essentially tells Balaam, no, you're not going to curse the people of Israel. Instead, you're going to bless them. And now Balaam's kind of in a pickle, because he has to go up to this mountain, he has to stand there with the king, and then when the king's expecting him to curse Israel, well, he's going to bless him instead. And he gives four oracles. And this is one of the oracles that he gives. The oracle of Balaam, the son of Beor. The oracle of the man whose eye is opened. The oracle of him who hears the words of God and knows the knowledge of the Most High, and who sees the vision of the Almighty, falling down with his eyes uncovered. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but he is not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. I would like to see the king's facial expression when those words started coming out of Balaam's mouth. He brought him over here. He's paying him to curse Israel. What's this business about a star coming out of Israel? Why is there a scepter? Who is this king? Now, the connection to the Magi story is that the Magi are looking for the promised king of Israel. And he is the promised king from this story. A star has risen out of Israel. It has guided the Magi to Israel. But I don't know if you remember the rest of that reading, because it makes the fact that the Magi are coming to Jerusalem and to Bethlehem more strange. They shouldn't be going to Jerusalem. They shouldn't be trying to find this king. In fact, if they know anything about these oracles, about the promised king to come, they should be getting on their best running shoes and go in the exact opposite direction, because the oracle continues, "It shall crush the forehead of Moab and break down the sons of Seth." And it goes on like this. Essentially, the Gentile cities are going to be torn down brick by brick. Their land is going to be salted. It's going to be not a good time for the for the people that aren't of Israel, for the non-Jews. And yet, here comes these three Gentiles. And not just Gentiles, but like Gentiles 2.0. They're the ones with the big beards and the wizard stuff and the stars and everything like that. They're coming to Bethlehem, seeking this king. Now, even if they don't know this prophecy, even if they've never read a piece of scripture, which I think is very likely that they never had, or else they would have known to go to Bethlehem. The scriptures are pretty clear about that. Instead, as we hear in the story, they went to Jerusalem first, looking for the king. It still doesn't answer the question, why do they come? Why? Why get out of bed in the morning? I would like to hear their answer. And the Bible gives an answer, but again, as the Bible likes to do, it's not an answer that completely fulfills my desire to know every aspect of what was going on. All they say is that we've come to worship him, born the king of the Jews. I would like to hear that explanation as they give it to their family and friends back at home as they pack up for who knows how many years long of a journey to go find this person because they saw a star. Honey, where are you going again? Oh, we're going to go worship the king of the Jews. He was born in Jerusalem. The king of the who? They may have not even known who the Jews were. If they did, they're like, the Jews? Aren't those the people who came in to Canaan a long time ago and wiped out all the other people? Oh, yeah, them? Yeah, sounds like a good idea to go worship their new king. But that's the answer that they give. Now, I also like to think of the other side of the story. It's a small town. Bethlehem is, as I've heard it put, like a truck stop somewhere out in the Midwest, essentially. There's not a lot of business going on there. So I guarantee it, when the Magi showed up, well, the town was probably talking. If I know anything about small towns, it's that rumors can go pretty fast through them. I mean, that's what you have to do. You have to talk about people. Don't you see those weird guys walking in? So they come into the town. They're complete strangers. They're odd. Like I said, they are wearing strange clothes. They're Gentiles. They're Gentile worshipers. And they go seek out the house of Mary and Joseph. And I wonder what Joseph's reaction was. He's probably outside, and he sees these Magi, and he's probably like, all right. He already knows that this whole pregnancy thing has been weird from the get-go. So he's not, he's a little bit concerned, like, what is happening next? Probably covers himself up, and the Magi, he's like, please don't, like, they're going to walk by the house. Oh, they're walking by the, oh, no, they're right here. Oh, okay, they're at my door. And they come, and they probably have this really thick accent, and they say, hey, we've come to worship the one born, the king of the Jews. What's going through Joseph's head right now? Oh, they're not home, or they're a Nazareth, or, oh, it's really nice to meet you. Let's go maybe get some coffee down away from my house. Please don't get close to my wife and newborn child, please. Those are the reactions I would think that Joseph may have had. But they bring him in. It says that the Magi entered the home, and they saw the mother with the child. And they fell down immediately, and they worshiped them. And this is like radical hospitality, that you let these strangers into your home, people who the whole town you know is looking at you and being like, who are they letting into their home now? These Magi? These sorcerers, these wizards, whatever they're doing, why are they bringing him in? Oh, I see what sort of family Mary and Joseph are. And again, there's already plenty of rumors about Mary and Joseph, so any reputation they had is now completely out the window. But no, they show hospitality. They bring them into the house, they open up the door, they let them onto their floor, and they let them worship. And furthermore, they accept their gifts. Now, that's always kind of struck me as odd. These strangers are coming to give you gifts. What's your reaction? I know we're kind of always bashful about getting gifts, at least even in this culture, like, oh, no, no, thanks, but I'm okay. We don't hear that. We don't see that. They accept them. And by doing that, they give a huge gift to the Magi. They let them come in, and they let them give what they can. Now, how is this sort of radical hospitality possible? It's because of who they are worshiping at the moment. Yes, Christ is the one prophesied in that Numbers chapter. He is the star that's coming out of Jacob, and he's the scepter that comes out of Israel. He's the king of the Jews, the king of Israel. But he's more than that. He's also the king of all creation. He's the one who creates life. He's the one that gives us breath. That's the great equalizer in that room. Before Christ the king, before Christ the creator, they're all just creations. Mary, Joseph, the Magi, their neighbors who are probably peeking through a window trying to see what's going on, they're all equalized in that moment. They've come to worship the king, and there they're equal. And looking around us right now, that tradition continues. The Christian church has reached out to people of all nations, has spread across the world. It's gone out from Israel. How many of us in this room, and I'm kind of just curious, could claim a Jewish background for ourselves? It doesn't look like any of us can. I don't see any hands up there either. No, so we are those Gentiles. We are those weird-smelling people that dress funny, coming up and being accepted into this room. It's because that king in that room and that creator in that room has loved us all. And that has continued out from here. But how does this work in our day-to-day lives, this sort of hospitality, this sort of ability to see that everyone else is a created being from God? I'm reminded of, I travel a lot. I'll start with that. I live in St. Louis, but I come home very often, which is a great blessing to me. And I always try to strike up conversations with people next to me on the plane because my headphones don't quite work in my phone. I've dropped it a lot. And it's kind of a blessing in disguise because I get to have all these neat conversations. And it's last time I was flying with this woman named Rose. She's from Eugene, Oregon, and we talked a lot. She was very into music. I know a little bit about music, so, you know, I was trying to sound like I knew more than I did, I'm sure. But she could probably tell because she's like this master organist, a doctor in music, whatnot. And she asked me about where am I going to school. Oh, I go to school at the seminary. Oh, I hear they have a nice church. I'm like, oh, yeah, I seem to know not a lot about organs. Where do you go to church? And she tells me the name of her church, and suddenly alarm bells start going off in my head because it's a Christian Scientist church. And everything that I've learned at seminaries is just like ringing. I'm going through all the files like, bad theology, wrong, not good. Get clear the area. It's time to label out, okay, ma'am, here's point by point why you're wrong and why you need to be a Lutheran now. Go. It's what they teach us at seminary sometimes. I'm not sure if it's what they want to teach us, but sometimes it's what happens. And I had to quiet down those bells because that wasn't the point of this conversation. My goal wasn't to try to turn her into a Lutheran in 4 hours or less, as much as that game sounds fun to me. And it does. My goal wasn't to explain why Christian Science isn't really Christian or scientific much at all. Instead, my goal was to be with the person that God had put me next to on a plane and to have a conversation with her. And throughout the conversation, I decided, well, I'm not going to be able to convert her to Lutheranism now, but she's always wanted to see a Caroline Bell system, which we have at our school. And I didn't know what they were before I went there, but they wake me up every morning. So now I know very much what they are. They're big, loud bells that sit in towers. So I'm like, you know, why don't you come by sometime? We exchanged some contact information. And while we haven't really talked yet, I know how I can get a hold of her. And I know that she knows that Concordia Seminary St. Louis is a place that she's always welcome to come. So when that person comes in to our church service, a Christian scientist, a magi, someone strange, someone from a different religion, what sort of hospitality do we show? Do we try to tell them how they're wrong coming in here? Is that where we start? Now, I'm not saying I don't think that their theology is wrong. I very much do. I'm still on that. But we bring them in and we remember that Christ is our King and Christ is all of our Creator. We bring them in. We show them hospitality. We don't worry about what our neighbors are thinking. We don't worry about how many checks we can get off on our side in the conversation. Instead, we show radical hospitality, the same sort of hospitality that God showed the Magi, that God showed Mary and Joseph, that God has shown everyone on this earth by being in our presence and by inviting us into his presence. That's what we do. So join me in a word of prayer. Tell them about that for you.